Chapter 58. A mile off. It is cruelty to me, she said. How can you treat me to this talk, if you care ever so little for me? True, true, he said, wincing a little. Did not come to reproach you for my deeds. I came, Tess, to say that I don't like you to be working like this, and I have come on purpose for you. You say you have a husband who is not one. Well, perhaps you have, but I've never seen him, and you've not told me his name, and altogether he seems rather a mythological personage. However, even if you have one, I think I am nearer to you than he is. I, at any rate, try to help you out of trouble, but he does not, bless his invisible face. The words of the stern prophet Hosea that I used to read come back to me. Don't you know them, Tess? And she shall follow after her lover, but she shall not overtake him, and she shall seek him, but shall not find him. Then shall she say, I will go, and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. Apostrophe. Dot dot tess, my trap is waiting just under the hill, and darling mine, not his, you know the rest. Her face had been rising to a dull crimson fire while he spoke, but she did not answer. You have been the cause of my backsliding, he continued, stretching his arm towards her waist. You should be willing to share it, and leave that mule you call husband forever. One of her leather gloves, which as he had taken off to eat her skimmer cake, lay in her lap, and without the slightest warning she passionately swung the glove by the gauntlet directly in his face. It was heavy and thick as a warrior's, and it struck him flat on the mouth. Fancy might have regarded the act as the recrudescence of a trick in which her armed progenitors were not unpracticed. Alec fiercely started up from his reclining position. A scarlet oozing appeared, where her blow had alighted, and in a moment the blood began dropping from his mouth upon the straw. But he soon controlled himself, calmly drew his handkerchief from his pocket, and mopped his bleeding lips. She too had sprung up, but she sank down again. And now, punish me, she said, turning up her eyes to him with the hopeless defiance of the sparrow's gaze before its captor twists its neck. Hit me, crush me, you need not mind those people under the rick. I shall not cry out. Once victim, always victim, that's the law. Oh no, no, Tess, he said blandly, can make full allowance for this. Yet you most unjustly forget one thing, that I would have married you, if you had not put it out of my power to do so. Did I not ask you flatly, to be my wife, hey? Answer me. You did. And you cannot be. But remember one thing. His voice hardened as his temper got the better of him with the recollection of his sincerity in asking her and her present ingratitude, and he stepped across to her side, and held her by the shoulders, so that she shook under his grasp. Emimer, my lady, I was your master once. I will be your master again. If you are any man's wife, you are mine. The threshers now began to stir below. So much for our quarrel, he said, letting her go. Now I shall leave you, and shall come again for your answer during the afternoon. You don't know me yet, but I know you. As he had not spoken again, remaining as if stunned. D'Urberville retreated over the sheaves, and descended the ladder, while the workers below rose, and stretched their arms, and shook down the beer they had drunk. Then the threshing machine started afresh. And amid the renewed rustle of the straw, Tess resumed her position by the buzzing drum as one in a dream, untying sheaf after sheaf in endless succession. XLVIII, in the afternoon the farmer made it known that the rick was to be finished that night, since there was a moon by which they could see to work, and the man with the engine was engaged for another farm on the morrow. Hence the twinging and humming and rustling proceeded with even less intermission than usual. It was not till amid time, about 3 o'clock, that Tess raised her eyes, and gave a momentary glance round. She felt but little surprise at seeing that Alec D'Urberville had come back, and was standing under the hedge by the gate. He had seen her lift her eyes, and waved his hand urbanely to her, while he blew her a kiss. It meant that their quarrel was over. Tess looked down again, and carefully abstained from gazing in that direction. Thus the afternoon dragged on. The wheat rick shrank lower, and the straw rick grew higher, and the corn sacks were carted away. At 6 o'clock the wheat rick was about shoulder high from the ground. But the unthreshed sheaves remaining untouched seemed countless still, notwithstanding the enormous numbers that had been gulped down by the insatiable swallower, fed by the man and Tess, through whose two young hands the greater part of them had passed. And the immense stack of straw, where in the morning there had been nothing, appeared as the feces of the same buzzing red glutton. From the west sky a wrathful shine all that wild March could afford in the way of sunset had burst forth after the cloudy day, flooding the tired and sticky faces of the threshers, and dyeing them with a coppery light, as also the flapping garments of the women, which clung to them like dull flames. A panting ache ran through the rick. The man who fed was weary, and Tess could see that the red nape of his neck was encrusted with dirt and husks. She still stood at her post, her flushed and perspiring face coated with the corn dust, and her white bonnet embrued by it. She was the only woman whose place was upon the machine so as to be shaken bodily by its spinning, and the decrease of the stack now separated her from Marion and Iz, and prevented their changing duties with her as they had done. The incessant quivering, in which every fiber of her frame participated, had thrown her into a stupefied reverie in which her arms worked on independently of her consciousness. She hardly knew where she was, and did not hear Iz Hewitt tell her from below that her hair was tumbling down. By degrees the freshest among them began to grow cadaverous and saucer-eyed. Whenever Tess lifted her head she beheld always the great upgrown straw stack, with the men in shirt sleeves upon it, against the gray north sky, in front of it the long red elevator like a Jacob's ladder, on which a perpetual stream of threshed straw ascended, a yellow river running uphill, and spouting out on the top of the rick. She knew that Alec d'Urberville was still on the scene, observing her from some point or other, though she could not say where. There was an excuse for his remaining, for when the threshed rick drew near its final sheaves a little ratting was always done, and men unconnected with the threshing sometimes dropped in for that performance sporting characters of all descriptions, gents with terriers and facetious pipes, roughs with sticks and stones. But there was another hour's work before the layer of live rats at the base of the stack would be reached. And as the evening light in the direction of the Giant's Hill by Abbot's Cernel dissolved away, the white-faced moon of the season arose from the horizon that lay towards Middleton Abbey and Shottsford on the other side. For the last hour or two Marion had felt uneasy about Tess, whom she could not get near enough to speak to, the other women having kept up their strength by drinking ale, and Tess having done without it through traditionary dread, owing to its results at her home in childhood. But Tess still kept going. If she could not fill her part she would have to leave, and this contingency, which she would have regarded with equanimity, and even with relief a month or two earlier, had become a terror since d'Urberville had begun to hover round her. The sheaf pitchers and feeders had now worked the rick so low that people on the ground could talk to them. To Tess's surprise, Farmer Groby came up on the machine to her and said that, if she desired to join her friend, he did not wish her to keep on any longer and would send somebody else to take her place. The reed was d'Urberville, she knew, and also that this concession had been granted in obedience to the request of that friend, her enemy. She shook her head and toiled on. The time for the rat-catching arrived at last, and the hunt began. The creatures had crept downwards with the subsidence of the rick till they were all together at the bottom, and being now uncovered from their last refuge they ran across the open ground in all directions, a loud shriek from the by this time half-tipsy Marion informing her companions that one of the rats had invaded her person, a terror which the rest of the women had guarded against by various schemes of skirt-tucking and self-elevation. The rat was at last dislodged, and, amid the barking of dogs, masculine shouts, feminine screams, oaths, stampings, and confusion as of pandemonium, Tess untied her last sheaf. The drum slowed, the whizzing ceased, and she stepped from the machine to the ground. Her lover, who had only looked on at the rat catching, was promptly at her side. "What after all my insulting slept to?" said she in an underbreath. She was so utterly exhausted that she had not strength to speak louder. "I should indeed be foolish to feel offended at anything you say or do," he answered, in the seductive voice of the Trantridge time. "How the little limbs tremble! You are as weak as a bled calf, you know you are, and yet you need have done nothing since I arrived. How could you be so obstinate? However, I have told the farmer that he has no right to employ women at steam threshing. It is not proper work for them, and on all the better class of farms it has been given up, as he knows very well. I will walk with you as far as your home." "Oh yes," she answered with a jaded gait. "Walk why me if you will. I do bear in mind that you came to marry me before you knew all my state. Perhaps you are a little better and kinder than I have been thinking you were. Whatever is meant by kindness I am grateful for, whatever is meant in any other way I am angered at. I cannot sense your meaning sometimes. If I cannot legitimize our former relations, at least I can assist you. And I will do it with much more regard for your feelings than I formerly showed. My religious mania, or whatever it was, is over. But I retain a little good nature, I hope I do. Now, Tess, by all that's tender and strong between man and woman, trust me. I have enough, and more than enough, to put you out of anxiety, both for yourself and your parents and sisters. I can make them all comfortable, if you will only show confidence in me." "Have you seen them lately?" she quickly inquired. "Yes. They didn't know where you were. It was only by chance that I found you here." The cold moon looked aslant upon Tess's fagged face between the twigs of the garden hedge as she paused outside the cottage which was her temporary home, D'Urberville pausing beside her. "Don't mention my little brothers and sisters, don't make me break down quite," she said. "If you want to help them, God knows they need it, do it without telling me. But no, no," she cried. "We'll take nothing from you, either for them or for me." He did not accompany her further, since, as she lived with the household, all was public indoors. No sooner had she herself entered, laved herself in the washing tub, and shared supper with the family than she fell into thought, and withdrawing to the table under the wall, by the light of her own little lamp wrote in a passionate mood, "My own husband, let me call you, so I must, even if it makes you angry to think of such an unworthy wife as I must cry to you in my trouble, I have no one else. I am so exposed to temptation, Angel. I fear to say who it is, and I do not like to write about it at all. But I cling to you in a way you cannot think. Can you not come to me now, at once, before anything terrible happens? Oh, I know you cannot, because you are so far away. I think I must die if you do not come soon, or tell me to come to you. The punishment you have measured out to me is deserved, I do know that well deserved, and you are right, and just to be angry with me. But, Angel, please, please, not to be just only a little kind to me, even if I do not deserve it, and come to me. If you would come, I could die in your arms. I would be well content to do that, if so be you had forgiven me. Angel, I live entirely for you. I love you too much to blame you for going away, and I know it was necessary you should find a farm. Do not think I shall say a word of sting or bitterness. Only come back to me. I am desolate without you, my darling, oh, so desolate. I do not mind having to work. But if you will send me one little line, and say, I am coming soon, I will bide on, Angel, oh, so cheerfully. It has been so much my religion ever, since we were married, to be faithful to you in every thought and look, that even when a man speaks a compliment to me, before I am aware, it seems wronging you. Have you never felt one little bit of what you used to feel when? Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.